We're just having a discussion about the fact that we're commanded by the Torah to only believe as revelation, only to accept revelation if it's based upon the proper foundations. That's a fundamental of fundamentals. How do we know that the system we're following is from God? That's the most essential question when a person is thinking about religion. So we've gone through the so-called foundations that if you study the Torah carefully, you'll see that God revealed the Torah to us in a unique kind of a manner, and that Judaism is therefore different than all of the other religions as far as that is concerned. Because the first question that a person has to ask when it comes to a religion, if someone is approaching him, no matter who it is, or if it's the so-called the prophet or the one who's establishing the religion, or it's a representative of the religion, I would assume that the first question a person is going to ask is, how do I know? How do I know that your system comes from God? If a person just accepts it without inquiring into it, it seems to me that person is a fool. And I don't think that the person would use that kind of a method in any other area. That is, if somebody were to come to them in the same way, but instead of proposing that they follow a certain religion, they propose that they invest their money with them. And they use the same claim that the system that they're using is from God, that God told them, and so on and so forth. If you had a situation like that where somebody came to you with God told me and all of that, but it meant that you should invest all of your money with the person, I don't think people would have such faith. It's an amazing phenomenon. I don't think a person would give up all of his money. I mean, some people would, because you know, this is a very powerful need in man. It's a very, very significant weakness in a person that he's willing to give over, so to speak, his faculty of reason, of knowing, on the basis of something which is very authoritative to him. People are in search of authority. It relieves them of responsibility, gives them a certain feeling of security. It doesn't mean that they have the actuality of security, it just gives them a feeling of security. And people will do a tremendous amount for the sake of having such a feeling. It's always when you read about these scam artists and con artists, you wonder how people could have been so stupid that the slightest bit of investigation and critical thinking, they would have been able to unearth what's going on. But there's a tremendous need to believe. But still, I think that if it was a matter of money, people would be more skeptical. But when it comes to something which is obviously so much more important than money, then people are not skeptical. So Judaism is geared towards a person who's going to be skeptical, who's going to think, who's going to use his mind. And you study the entire history, so to speak, of how Judaism came into being, starting from Avraham Avinu, who used his mind, and on the basis of knowledge and understanding and reason. That's all that a person has. That's the divine element, the so-called Tzelem Elokim. And as we said, then you go on to Moshe Rabbeinu, that when God was sending him to go to the Jews, so he expressed the fact that they're going to question me. On two different levels. First of all, what is your name? The knowledge of God, the idea of God. And if he fails in that area, then they're just going to reject him. So he's saying something about the nature of the Jews by that time, that the Jews by that time already were not just going to listen to anyone. And then, of course, he demands proofs, signs and wonders and so forth. And as we said, that's an important element, which comes into the picture later on, that even miracles, the greatest miracles in and of themselves, cannot verify something which we know to be false. And then, of course, ultimately, as the Rambam describes in Yesodei HaTorah, that when God revealed himself to the Jews, when God gave them the Torah, he did not even rely on the power of miracles as the power of persuasion. In spite of all the miracles that had taken place, those in Egypt and the splitting of the Red Sea, which, when you read about it, seems to be absolutely convincing. Anyone puts himself in that situation of what happened and how the Jews were saved and the Egyptians were drowned would be absolutely convinced. And it says that the people believed in God and his servant Moses. And still, that was not enough. God did not choose to base the revelation on the phenomenon of miracles, that the Jews would know it's from God because certain miracles would be performed. It would have to be something beyond miracles, which was what we call the mass revelation at Sinai, where the people heard face to face, so to speak. And that left no room for doubt. And that's what it says in Devarim, that such a phenomenon could never ever happen. Never happened before, never happened again. And that's what Moshe tells the people to study history. And you'll see. Inquire, use your mind, and you'll see that such a thing never ever happened, and such a thing could never happen. Now, it's a long... This is the criteria, then. And really, this is all by way of review. It doesn't hurt, especially at this time of the year. We're heading towards Pesach, which is the foundation of Judaism. That there's really two types of criteria. This is very, very important. Two reinforcing sets of considerations which enable a person to be absolutely confident that the Torah is from God. One is the foundation of Torah Misinai, which, as we said, is never happened before, would never happen again. And if you study the ideas behind it, which we're not going into now specifically, all the particular ideas, how we know that the event occurred, gives us a way of establishing that the Torah that we have is divine. That's only, however, step one. You'd imagine that if that's all that we had, then we'd have to follow it. That would be sufficient, then we'd follow it. Even if there was nothing beyond that. That is to say, if it just conveyed a certain set of rules and regulations which we really could not make any sense out of, let's imagine for a moment that Judaism was different and it was not a religion that appealed to the mind at all. It was just a series of what would seem to us to be arbitrary activities which we wouldn't even understand what the purpose was, what the benefit was. Still, we're being told we have all this information that this is from God. So I would say a person would still do it. Because if the foundation is so compelling that it leaves no room for doubt that it comes from God, I guess there might be, I mean, this is a hypothetical. What if? You know, one could raise questions. What if with this very same foundation we were being commanded to do things which would be utterly absurd? That could be put you in a dilemma. But I'm saying even if it wasn't absurd, there's three different possibilities. There's something which is absurd and contrary to anything that we would imagine would make sense. But then there's something which is not absurd, it's just that we don't understand the reason. I would use the word arbitrary, perhaps. Or perhaps we would say meaningless. It has no meaning for us. We can't discover any meaning in it, any rhyme or reason, but that's not the same thing as saying it's absurd. In that case, we would do it, because God is commanding you to do it. So if God commands you to do something, if you recognize God as the source, as the creator, as the ultimate in terms of wisdom and knowledge, so we'd follow God. However, when it comes to the Torah, it's more than that. There's a secondary level of proof, and that is, we see that the Torah is from God when you study the Torah. And that is to say that, theoretically, if a person did not have the proof of Sinai, and he just began to study the Torah, and he wasn't even aware of the proofs, he, if he was studying properly, and he had the right teachers, and he had the intelligence and clarity and objectivity, he would discover that there's nothing like it. He would discover that it's different, that it's unique, that it's an expression of infinite wisdom. Anyone who studies the Torah properly comes to that conclusion. And therefore, he would say that this is not an ordinary book. And he would recognize that it comes from a different source, because it reflects a wisdom which is infinite. So really, you have both. Now, that person, a rational person, would come to the conclusion that it must be from God. Then he would discover the proof, then that would confirm what he already knows. If that's the case, if the Torah is absolutely true and convincing, if you study it properly, then you could ask, so why do we need the first proof, the proof of Torah Misinai? And the answer to that is that that's just to establish a foundation. Because most people are not on that level. Most people are not going to be able to come to the level of appreciating Torah through the intrinsic study, through the intellectual perception. And therefore, if you want, in order to have an entire nation that's going to keep, there's many considerations. Not everybody is going to be a great Torah scholar and reach that level of understanding and appreciation and recognition. And in the immediate case, the objective is that the people should accept the system and live by the system. Everybody has to live by the system of Torah and follow the commandments. And even the scholar, at first, what is going to prompt him to make that investment of time and energy? Why should he put all of his energies into studying the Torah and reach that level unless he knows he's got to have good reason that this is worth studying? So the so-called foundation or proof of Torah Misinai is needed to establish the foundation. And that gives you a solid foundation which differentiates Judaism from all the other religions. And the person has a secure basis to recognize that this comes from God. Now, once you understand that, it makes sense to keep it, to observe it, and so on and so forth. But you shouldn't be content with that, because merely to observe it in a superficial way means you will not be getting the real benefits of what the system has to offer. And the more you ponder it, the more you study it, the more you uncover all of the wisdom. And this only reinforces your conviction. Once a person studies Torah in the correct way, the experience that he has reinforces his conviction that this is from God. And he doesn't have to constantly be making recourse to the original proof. That was only to get him there in the first place. It's like that in many areas. It's sort of, just for the sake of description, in order to ascertain if someone is an expert, doctor, so you may have to have certain criteria. Because you don't know who's the expert and who's not. So you make a great effort, then you may have to trial and error, you may have to reject certain and accept others. But once you find the right one, and that's true in many areas, once you find the right teacher, once you find the right trainer and so forth, then the treatment itself becomes the proof. It doesn't matter anymore how you arrived at this in the first place. You can see from the treatment itself that this is the correct one. So that's the foundation. And that's how we know that the Torah is true. Now, once you know that the Torah is true, it becomes very easy, as I pointed out. I'm kind of reviewing a little bit the talk that I gave in that meeting where Rabbi Greenberg presented pluralism and I did the rejoinder. Once you know that the Torah is true, you accept the Torah according to the written law and the oral law. I'm basing myself, obviously, on that perspective. If you don't accept that perspective, then you have no way to ascertain that anything is true. The Torah itself takes up the issue of future prophecies. Will there be prophecy after Moshe? Is the Torah the only revelation? Is the Torah progressive? Are things going to be added to the Torah? Are changes going to be made? And so on. And this the Rambam makes clear in the laws of Yesodei Torah, foundations of the Torah, that the Torah is eternal, that it's never to be abolished, it's eternal. at the Torah is perfect and can't be altered in any way. You can't add to it and you can't subtract from it. And the Torah is exclusive, meaning this is very, very important. Because people may accept these points, but they'll say, yeah, but that's for the Jews. Who is to say that God will not have other revelations for other peoples? The so-called argument that God speaks to many people in many languages, whatever the case. However, you want to put, people like to put these things in a poetic form. So somehow or other, it seems to give some credence to it, which is not the case, though. Just because you put something in a fancy phrase doesn't give the idea behind it any credence. But the idea of Torah is that that is it. There is not ever going to be another revelation from God. When I say revelation, I mean not that there won't be prophecy. By revelation, I mean in the sense that God is revealing His will in terms of commandments, in terms of what we would call religion, in terms of how man ought to live and serve God. That is complete, and that's expressed in the statement, Lo b'shamayim hi, that it's not in heaven. That's a very, very significant statement. It is not in heaven. We learn many things from that. And to put it descriptively, it's as though there was something in heaven called the revelation. It was intended for mankind. At a certain point in time, it was transmitted to mankind, and now it's yours. It's not in heaven anymore. Don't look to heaven for revelation. You will not find it in heaven. It's here on earth, which means that all that you need to serve God, all of the direction, the rules, the regulations, the do's and the don'ts are already on earth. And another significant meaning is, it's not that simple, obviously. There's a very profound system, and decisions have to be made. Determination of what the law is, because Torah is very vast and complex. So this is a very significant principle, that whenever there's a discussion, there's a certain, not just that the Torah was given over, but the methodologies by which conclusions are reached. The methodologies that are used are given over to man, and that's the system. You can't make recourse to revelation, even in terms of deciding a halachic issue. If there's a halachic issue, so you have certain procedures. There may be disagreements, there's arguments, there's many, many halachic arguments. Then we have the principles by which these arguments are resolved, the issues are resolved. And if a person seeks to make recourse to heaven, that is some kind of a divine sign, a miracle. He'll do a miracle, or there'll be a sign, or he claims that he's a prophet and God has sent him to clarify the law of the Torah, and that the Sanhedrin or the majority has made a mistake and that's not the way the law ought to be. If a person should claim that, then that person is, by definition, a false prophet, because it's in violation of the statement, it is not in heaven. That is, you cannot have any recourse to heaven anymore. God gave it over to man, and that's the will of God, that He established a system, and that's Torah. Whether, in point of fact, at a given time, the system will come to a conclusion which is the wrong conclusion, in terms of absolute truth. That is, if God, what does God say? Does God agree with this decision? It's possible that God doesn't agree with the decision, but God gave it over to man, and assuming that you're operating with legitimacy, you're following the system that the God gave you, so it is possible human beings, judges, and so on and so forth, can make a mistake. And sometimes the minority is correct and the majority is wrong, but God commanded us to establish and fulfill the halachic system in accordance with these guidelines, with the majority, whatever it may be, and do not turn to heaven anymore, because it's not in heaven. So there's no further revelation in heaven. Now, once you have these basic principles of Torah, and you understand the issue of prophecy, now you might ask, what's the purpose of prophecy? There's no further revelation, so that should be the end of prophecy. Why do we have prophecy after the Torah was given? And that's something which the Rambam addresses, the Torah addresses. And Moshe himself says, in the name of God, I will appoint a prophet. God says, Kamoni, like me, Moshe says. And that is that the phenomenon of prophecy will continue, but it's very, very clear that it cannot be to, it can't be in contravention, in contradiction to anything that's part of Torah's Moshe. Indeed, we do not follow an individual who claims to be a prophet because of a miracle that he does or anything else that he does. The only reason why we would even consider a prophet is because we're commanded to do so in the Torah. So after the Torah is given, whatever we do or don't do is only because it was commanded in the Torah. So thus, a prophet has to conform to the requirements of the Torah, what the Torah, the guidelines of the Torah. And therefore, if the prophet speaks contrarily to the Torah or contradicts the Torah, it is known that he's false. That's an important point. And aside from that, it's also important to remember that we have criteria determining what is a prophet, who is a prophet. And all of the individuals in history, except for the approved prophets, the prophets that we have, and by the way, the whole world accepts these prophets. That's the amazing thing, that all of the people who contend that they have another religion, another revelation, are not coming from a different foundation. If they were doing that, so that's a different story. There's nothing really to argue about. We would just analyze what their basis of their revelation is, and we'd show you that it's all based on faith, on emotion. But the irony is that they all acknowledge the Torah, and all the prophets of the Torah. Not just Moses, but after Moshe. Joshua, and Yirmiyahu, and Isaiah, and Micah, and all the prophets. So there have been many, many prophets. They were all verified by who? How did they know that Joshua was a prophet? They were all verified by the rabbis, by the sages, who were operating with the Torah criteria. And thus, whoever is not part of that list obviously didn't meet the test. As I pointed out, the last of the prophets is Micah, who lived a few hundred years before Jesus. So there's no prophets. That's an established point. But all of the other religions cannot lay any claim to revelation, and when they do so, they're total lies, they're frauds, which is the greatest possible fraud in the world. There's no greater fraud than to misuse the name of God and try and use the name of God to mislead people in terms of religion. Not just that, but to take them away from the actual revelation. That's the big, big crime. Because it was the will of God that all of mankind should benefit from this. This is the revelation. But coming along and negating it and saying that it was abrogated, the law of God is abrogated, that's a violation of the Torah itself, which the Torah says that it's forever. The Torah itself claims it can never be abrogated. And by doing that, and by establishing what they claim is a new the very claim of a new revelation in and of itself must be false because it's contrary to the Torah, which says it's not in heaven. So there is no other revelation. And this is the revelation. The only question is if you're a Jew or if you're a non-Jew. The revelation is there for everybody. The revelation in terms of how you ought to live your life philosophically is for everybody. There's no difference. It's a system of perfection which enlightens every area of life. So it's not even like a religion in the ordinary sense. And in terms of a specific system of commandments to live by and to avoid, so there's the 613 commandments, which applies to the Jew, and then there's the Noahide system of seven commandments. Seven binding commandments plus what you want to do on an optional basis. You can't add or detract. You can't change. The system is always perfect, cannot be altered. Just like a Jew can't alter the system, a Noahide can't alter their system either in terms of adding or subtracting. When they do so, in terms of trying to alter, to make a different kind of system, they can take on more. They can't do less, but they can take on more on a voluntary basis for the sake of reward, so to speak. According to the way I'm learning it, it's obvious from this that a believing Jew must hold that the other religions are, by definition, false. I don't see how anybody can give credence to those religions, even if you didn't have the Torah. If I didn't have the Torah, I still wouldn't give credence to any of the religions, because if they came to me, I would ask them for proof. And I would examine what the basis of why should I believe their claims? Christianity, all of Christianity's claims are contrary to reason, don't make any sense whatsoever. The whole system, the whole theology doesn't make any sense. That man is a fallen being, that he's evil by nature, that he doesn't have free will. I mean, they're all loaded with contradictions, every idea that they have. But the idea, their idea of God, that he became a person, and then just wound up on the cross, couldn't defend himself, died for your sins. All of these things do not make any sense. I don't see how anybody can understand them. It's not even intelligible. It's not lucid. If somebody came to you with these ideas, you'd think there's something seriously mentally wrong with this person. If it wasn't for the fact that this is now an established religion, and so many millions of people believe it, and it has a certain respectability, if it didn't have that, and somebody came to you, which is the way you should look at it, and just was trying to convince you to accept the system, you'd think the person is crazy. Both of the religions, there's no religion that recommends itself as something which an intelligent person, a philosopher, would want to embrace. And insofar as their claims that this is from God, what's their proof? What proof do they have that this is from God? An intelligent person, you have to realize, wouldn't even find it necessary to ask such a question, because how can something which is absurd come from God? I mean, that's totally ridiculous. So therefore, we're obligated to reject the claim. I went further in my talk. I wasn't content to leave it at that. I wanted to show that you can't have it both ways. That if somebody comes to you with a claim of revelation, with a claim of prophecy, so then we're obligated to, the Torah obligates us, since it's a mitzvah, to follow prophecy. If it's genuine, you have a mitzvah. You can't just stand on the fence, so to speak. And you're obligated to reject it if it's false prophecy. And when Torah law applies, the false prophet is put to death, because that's the worst evil, to speak in God's name and mislead people. That destroys God's whole plan. God's plan for the universe is that mankind should have a way of knowing Him in order to perfect themselves. So can there be anything worse than a charlatan, a religious charlatan, who preys upon people's vulnerabilities in a certain area and misleads them in the worst possible way? Not just taking away their money, that's nothing, but taking away their souls. Can there be anyone who's in greater opposition to the will of God than a false prophet? So then, if this is false, then you have to regard these people as liars. That is, the leaders of the other religions are all liars, charlatans. And The entire system is based on lies, and one lie, as I showed, one lie leads to another lie. In fact, it's interesting, I didn't make the point that night. I was limited in terms of time. But I'm sure you're all familiar with the idea of the big lie, which is attributed to Goebbels of the Nazis, that they perfected the technique of modern propaganda, and one of the things was the big lie. That if you take something which is very, very simple and it's outrageous, it's a big lie. The lies they said about the Jews, that the Jews had stabbed Germany in the back and so on and so forth. All the things they said were completely outrageous. But by virtue of making it simple and repeating it over and over and over again, so you can convince people that it's true. That's called the big lie. Because the average person, at first he can't believe, this is so outrageous, that he can't believe that anybody would say it, and therefore, if someone is saying it, it's not just someone, but the government and all the respected authorities are saying it over and over again, so then it must be true, because it's too outrageous. This technique of the big lie, I would say, goes back to Christianity. That's the big lie. the lie that God, who had given the Torah, had revealed himself to them and told them that they should abrogate the Torah, not to mention all the other crazy ideas that they came up with, the lie that he was a Messiah who didn't fulfill any of the simplest things that the Messiah had to do, and the lying in terms of going back to the texts, trying to find proof from the texts. The idea is so absurd. Judaism taught an idea of the Messiah, which everybody, up until the point of Jesus, had a general concept. We have a general concept of the Messiah, that he's going to be a powerful king who will save the Jews from their enemies and effectuate a transformation in the Jewish people, bringing all of them back to the way they ought to be in terms of observing the Torah and a light to the nations. And eventually, he'll rebuild the temple, and he'll be triumphant and usher in an era of everlasting peace. Everybody knew that. So to take someone, just read the life of Jesus, an absolute failure, didn't accomplish even on the slightest level any of those things. It was not even accepted by the Jews, by anyone. He had a few followers, perhaps. And then he was killed. He couldn't even defend himself. The whole thing was a failure. And then to go back to... So then what they did was, that whatever happened to him, as they imagined, if he was pierced, if this, if that. So then you go back to the sources and look through any source. Where can I find anything that has anything to do with pierced? And to distort the words and so on and so forth. The idea is an absolute absurdity. To try and find... It would be like we have the Constitution or whatever describing what the president is of the United States. And to take someone who was a Bowery bum, a homeless person, whatever the case is, and to say he was a president, and then to take certain things from his life and to go back and to try and find any kind of a word that could be misrepresented to apply in some kind of a crazy way to this person's life and say, to prove that he was the one that they were talking about, is an absolute absurdity. It's the more you talk about it, the more you wonder, how is it possible that this was established? It just doesn't... I can't understand it. Well, I mean, you can explain Christianity. Two things, first of all. First of all, there's the indoctrination factor. The power of indoctrination in the irrational. This is a frightening thing. That man, in spite of the fact that God gave him the Tzelem Elohim, the divine element, is so vulnerable to indoctrination. I mean, you have to guard your soul. It's scary. And the power of indoctrination and propaganda in childhood, and raising, if you raise people in a completely false system, you raise them with all of the religious emotions, then even when they get older and the mind opens up and they can reason, but they can't reason about certain things because of the tremendous factor of guilt. And closed-minded, it's a very, very powerful phenomenon. So you see that the system goes from one untruth to another untruth, from one falsehood to another. Because when the whole thing falls apart, because they couldn't deal with the fact that he failed as a Messiah, because he was killed. And he didn't do anything. So let's make up a lie. This is a beauty. What was the lie that they made up? Oh, that was the first coming. Now there'll be a second coming. To me, these things are so laughable. You could always, if that's the case, whenever I was supposed to do something for you, and I didn't do it, I could always say, well, yeah, that was in the first time around, but there'll be another time around, and then I will. I mean, the whole thing is an absolute absurdity. They just keep making up... And even if you want to say that, so then the answer to that should be, okay, well, wait. So why? Let's say someone doesn't see through the absurdity of such a thing. And that's the question. How could he be the Messiah if he didn't do anything that a Messiah is supposed to do? In fact, he was killed. Yeah, well, the answer is, of course, that's just the first time around. He's going to come around again. Well, I mean, that's you could always say that. Then you can make up a third coming. Once you could say that, and besides, you could say that about virtually anybody. Anyone that ever lived is the Messiah, because, well, you'll say, how can you say he's the Messiah? He didn't do anything. Yeah, he didn't do anything, but that was the first time around. He's going to do it the second time around. I mean, by that reasoning, everybody's the Messiah. There's no one that can't be the Messiah. But at least, if a Christian wants to entertain that idea, then the position will be okay when he comes back the second time. Then I'll believe in him. But right now he hasn't come, so why would I believe in him? Then they had to redefine the entire idea of the Messiah, that it wasn't, as we understand it, a political and religious leader who will save the Jews and transform the world, but now they meant it in the sense of a personal salvation. They introduced a new idea, which is not found in Judaism, the idea of salvation, which means that he died for your sins. So look at all the distortions. So that means that you're absolutely, you don't have free will, you're a sinner. One distortion, of course, the ultimate distortion was that he wasn't even Jesus, he was really God. I mean, the whole destruction of the idea of God. One lie leads to another lie. And then the charge against the Jews of deicide, that the Jews then become killers of God, which is the most absurd thing in the world. And all of the persecution of the Jews throughout history. Look at their record in history. The ideas, for example, I don't know if you're familiar with this, it's called the host. I didn't have enough time that night, but I brought along the book. This is something I read about this past summer. I couldn't believe what I was reading. I have a book to recommend to you. It's called Why the Jews, by Prager and Telushkin. It's one of the best, it's a popular version, but it's written very, very well, of the reasons for anti-Semitism. It's unique. It's not a complicated book to read, but it's really worth reading. The author show that, contrary to most people that are always trying to rationalize anti-Semitism and avoid the issue by making it other factors, economic factors, or the need for a scapegoat, or the outsider, they show that anti-Semitism was determined mainly by the religious views of the Jews. So it's very interesting. And it's very well written. One of the things that they talk about, Christian anti-Semitism, they talk about not just religious anti-Semitism, they also include secular anti-Semitism, Muslim anti-Semitism, and they analyze it very well. There's one part over there that tells another factor which influenced Christian anti-Semitism. Well, once they had the idea of deicide, so the Jews were finished, basically. That gave them the rationalization that they needed. The real motivation was some instinctual type of an aggressiveness and a hatred and a sadism. But of course they needed something to base it on. So religious hatred is the most gratifying, because you can get rid of all your instinctual energy and feel like you're a righteous person at the same time. That's the most lethal combination. You see it today in the Islamic world. And for centuries, the Christians were the ones who practiced it. So the charge of deicide was perfect, these passion plays, which would depict the Jews as inflicting pain and suffering on Jesus. The whole idea is an absolute absurdity. If you have a true idea of God, there's no way that man can harm God. But yet they were going out there, a sickness, going out there and taking revenge because people had hurt God. I mean, the whole thing is absolute primitivity. Now, they have this thing called the host. It's one of the sacraments of the church where they eat this cracker, this wafer, and they drink wine. Now, basically, originally, it had to do with the representing. The wafer represents the body of Jesus, and the wine is the blood. So they're eating the body, and they're drinking the blood. But there was a debate within the church as to whether this is just symbolic, it represents, or whether it's actual. That's called transubstantiation. It is the doctrine which maintains that it's not just a representation, a symbolic phenomenon, but that it's actually. Now, I know this makes absolutely no sense. There's no way the mind can grasp it. But at that moment, this wafer actually turns into the body of Jesus, which to them is God. I mean, and people eat it. Is there anything more primitive than that? But once the church adopted that doctrine, so now the Jews became vulnerable. They started accusing the Jews of what's called host abuse, that the Jews would take the host and they'd abuse it, that they would I guess, take a knife and stick it into the cracker to inflict more pain on their God. The whole idea makes absolutely no sense. It's the most primitive phenomenon in the world, but thousands of Jews were killed, were tortured, because of the allegation that they were still, did you see, according to them, the Jews couldn't stop torturing the Jesus. They couldn't stop. So now that they decided that the host is really Jesus, and then Jews are stealing the host, and just to inflict more pain. This is one lie leads to another lie, leads to not just lies, but the worst abuses. Parenthetically, one of the students asked, after I stated these ideas, that this is pure faith. In fact, I said that there's no... I answered my own question, and they've answered their own questions. That everything is absolutely contrary to reason on any level. So how can people accept it? They themselves provide the answer. There's a doctrine in Christianity called Creo que absurdo, which means basically, I believe that which is absurd, or because it's absurd. That was a doctrine which was elucidated by some Tertullian, one of their big theologians. That is their way of thinking. The more absurd, the better. Because it has nothing to do with reason. It's because the person believes in it. So the greatness is belief. If the greatness is belief, so then the more absurd it is, the greater the belief. Because if something makes sense and can be proved, then it's not belief, it's not faith. That's a fundamental of their whole way of approaching it. That if you could, they take something which is a defect and they make it into a virtue. Well, they have no choice. Where are they going to go? They can't. There's no way that you can, that reason can accept any of this nonsense. So then the answer is, yeah, well, that's the greatness. The greatness is that I don't use reason, that I have total faith. And we say that's all absurd. And then the question that I was asked was, well, what about the fact that they have had great minds and great thinkers and great philosophers and so on and so forth? Which I'll accept. There have been many great people throughout history in the sense of being great minds and even great thinkers who were Christians. And what about, you know, all their theologians and philosophers? They went into philosophy and so on and so forth. My answer to that is they were not genuine philosophers when it came to the issue of Christianity. It's sort of like a great lawyer who's ingenious in terms of all of his legal argumentations and so on and so forth. But then you'll say, well, but you maintain that his belief in the innocence, that he believes his client is innocent, is absurd. It's not based on any legitimate kind of legal thinking. So then you'll say, well, why do you know? This guy's a brilliant lawyer, and in court he only uses legal arguments and all that. Yeah, that's true, but that's not how he arrived at the conviction that his client is innocent. That has nothing to do with that. That he arrived at by other factors. Either it's because of the money, or it could be emotionally. It's like a parent believes her child is innocent no matter what, because she just can't accept the fact that her child could be guilty. And then if the parent is a great lawyer, then the mind will approach all the factors and use reason and the logic to manipulate the evidence, to make a legal case. That's what a lawyer does. But that's after the fact. That is, the decision that the client is innocent has nothing to do with reason in most cases. That's because of other factors. The same thing over here. The decision to be a Christian, to accept this, is based purely on faith. They didn't use reason to come to that conclusion. Having come to that conclusion, now they want to reinforce it. Now they're going to look at all the factors from that biased position, and they're intelligent, and they'll use their logic. It's like a lawyer is going to, you know, distort all of the evidence with legalistic thinking to cast a doubt or to make a case. That's the... there's no person in history, it's an impossibility, that anybody can approach their system on any level in an unbiased fashion, using reason and logic and objectivity, and come to the conclusion that there's any reason why a person could accept something like this. you can't even, the idea of the Trinity, for example, and the Trinity is one and it's really three. I mean, you can't even make sense out of what they're saying, never mind to reject it. You can't even understand what they're saying. It's not intelligible to the human mind. That's the power of faith. They are true people of faith, which means it has nothing to do with reality or reason or anything. It's just faith. If I can engender within myself a certain feeling that this is right, that's faith, and that's great. It's unfortunate that the Jews, having lived in these societies, Christian societies, have been influenced along the same lines to abandon the proper foundation of Torah, which is through knowledge and understanding and ascertaining, and pretty much have the same idea that there's something wonderful and beautiful about faith. From that comes this idea that we have to respect all peoples of faith, this a certain idea of respect for faith, whether we agree with it or not. I mean, that permeates the society as though there's something wonderful about having faith, whether you have it or not, which is not borne out. What's wonderful about it if it leads you to the most foolish notions? Not to mention the practical harm that people of faith have inflicted throughout history. Now, with this background, I want to take up a question that has been raised about the fact that it seems that people who are infused with a Christianity, some people anyways, and perhaps in modern times, seem to do things that are extremely compassionate. This was the point that was made by Rabbi Greenberg, that they go to Sri Lanka and it seems that they do unbelievable things in terms of how they help people in need and tend to people that are sick and so on and so forth. And thus you see that they do compassion, and that gives it some kind of a justification, or we could perhaps learn from their compassion, things of that sort. I just want to say at the outset that a religion or any other system has to be evaluated in terms of its ideas. And it has to make sense in terms of its claims, in terms of its ideas, in terms of its justifications. If you come to the conclusion that a system is false on the basis of the criteria that we've mentioned, so then it's false. If something is false, the fact that they do good things in no way, shape, or form casts has anything to do with the truthfulness. Because people do things for many, many, many reasons. So one should not be influenced by that. That's a dangerous tool. By the way, you should know that virtually every system in the world, within Judaism too, there's different kinds of movements among the Orthodox, conservative, reform, and virtually every movement in the world is going to automatically become involved in the practice of compassion. Precisely because it gives it a justification. That's a vulnerability of mankind, that people are affected by goodness, what they perceive as goodness. You don't know if it's goodness or not, you just see the result. But people set up missions on the highways, wherever it is, and you're a traveler, and you're vulnerable and you're in need, and then there's somebody out there that appears to care about you and takes care of your needs, you're being exploited in a certain way. Whether the intention is to exploit you or not, you're going to feel gratitude. And once you feel gratitude, you're going to look at that person in a different way. It's going to affect your way of thinking, your ideas as what is the good and what's not the good. And that's why virtually every religious group is going to get involved in these activities. Because they know it impresses people. So that can't be a factor. An intelligent person has to be in control of his emotions, even the emotion of gratitude. Just because you feel gratitude to someone, that's why the Torah really warns us about this, about keeping our distance from idol worshippers. And it mentions that you're not allowed even to praise idol worshippers. Even things that they're good looking or handsome, or certainly their good deeds, it mentions that. Because of this vulnerability. That once you receive a certain kindness from a person who's motivated by an ideology which is false. That's even the terrorist groups, even Hamas. The reason why they got elected is because people, well, one of the reasons anyways, people perceive the Palestinian Authority as being corrupt and self-serving, and these people are in the hospitals providing social services and caring about the people. That's it. That's a very powerful factor. So I'm not that impressed merely by the fact that, to me, that is not goodness. If a person is setting up a system of compassion for ulterior motives, that's not goodness that the Torah is talking about. Now, that doesn't mean that it's necessarily evil. The fact that somebody is doing something for an ulterior motive, if it's a good thing, that has a place in the world. The rabbis say, Mito shelo lishma bo lishma. They say that about the study of Torah. That you should study Torah even, it's very difficult at the outset to study Torah for the right reason, just because of the love of Torah. So there's always got to be a certain reward. And the rabbi talked about it to some of the Rambam mentions, that's how you have to raise children. They have to be external rewards. Because by nature, they're not geared to love study. And as they get older, the more they get involved in this, they'll begin to appreciate, they'll recognize the benefit of the study, as opposed to the other, what they thought was the good. There's a process of change. Now, they say that about Torah study. In terms of the compassion of the false ideologies, bear in mind, what is the agenda? What is the motive? Why are they doing this? Now, my point is not to say that there's nothing good about it. My point is to show you that we cannot really learn from it, because that is not the ideal of chesed that the Torah is teaching. The ideal of chesed that the Torah is teaching is a completely different one. It's called Torah's chesed. It's a Torah of compassion. Which means to say that the greatest example of compassion is Avraham, is Abraham. The real compassion is to assist people, to help people, in terms of achieving the good. And if a person does not have knowledge of the good, then A, he's very, very limited in terms of the compassion that he can perform. And the compassion he performs is not the ideal of Torah, because it doesn't necessarily elevate the soul. What do I mean by that? The fact that a person, I'll ask you the question, what is the good of compassion? Why is that a good thing? That I take away time from doing what I want to do, and I do things that are very painful to me. Taking care of ill people, doing things, all kinds of chores that I don't enjoy doing. What is the goodness over there? Why should I do a thing like that? Now, bear in mind, first of all, that compassion is rooted in the instinctual makeup of man. It's not necessarily a component of the divine element, of the Tzelem Elokim. Let me explain. Animals practice compassion as well. The practice, you'll see that. And animals have feelings as well. The Rambam makes this point, that the reason, this is the Rambam, the reason that you're not allowed to take the chicks before you send away the mother, the nesting mother, and you have to send away the mother, then take the chicks. The Rambam says it's because you're causing pain to the mother. The mother has a certain compassion for its own. And he says, don't think that the emotion of compassion is connected to the divine element, because animals have it too. So there is a very powerful instinct of compassion. And much of the compassion in this world has to do with that. You see that people that can be very, very selfish, but when it comes to their own children or people that they love, they're engaged in an emotion of compassion. Now, I'm not saying there's anything wrong with that. That's a level. It could lead you to a higher level. Because to the extent that you're doing things, you're separating yourself from the base egotism. This is also egotism. When a parent takes care of a child, it's the self. It's still ego. You're doing it for selfish reasons. It's a selfish phenomenon. But that type of compassion where a person is motivated that the doing, the helping of others becomes an end in itself, is basically an instinctive type of, it's an emotional thing. Now, I'm not saying these people, even when they don't have ulterior motives, there's a number of issues over here. I've mentioned ulterior motives, but right now, even if there's no ulterior motives, it means to say that a person is overcome by his emotions. He feels pity. He feels bad. Now, God implanted all these emotions within us, and they're necessary, but the emotion itself can't dictate the outcome. Just because I feel bad and I spend my whole life, years and years, toiling in Africa, in the primitive places, because I have a very powerful emotion, that this is what I ought to be doing, that doesn't make it the good. I'm just giving in to my emotions. My emotion of compassion. So you're strengthening that emotion within you. But how does that elevate your soul? Where's the elevation of the soul in all of that? Now, that very same compassion, Christian compassion, that very same emotion which will cause people to go off into the forest, into these villages, these primitive villages, and then put up with all of the illness and diseases, etc., and live a life of what we would call misery because of the compassion, that very same emotion will cause them, let me give you this example, let's assume that someone like Arafat, now he's dead, but someone like him, a terrorist, someone like Hitler even, were to fly over that area and his plane went down. And he would be in a situation where, left to his own, he would die. And a group of these missionaries would discover him. What would they do? They'd nurse him back to health. So you see that this is not compassion. This is a form of cruelty, because compassion that doesn't differentiate between the good and the bad, which they don't differentiate, they will give the same treatment regardless of who the person is, because to them, giving that treatment to a person is an end in itself, regardless of the effect. But how could that be? We maintain that it's good. Compassion is a good thing only if it's in line with the truth, with the ultimate good. That's why we speak of a compassion which is evil. You have to differentiate. You have to use your mind. That's why Saul was punished, because of an excess of compassion. He had compassion on Amalek. That's evil. And he lost the kingship because of that. The Talmud, the Gemara, says that whoever has mercy on a vicious person, achzar, in the end, he will be vicious to innocent people. There's an interesting Rambam I want to share with you. This is in Hilchos, Laws of Sanhedrin, chapter 11. Halacha Hey. Anyone that's familiar with the laws of the Sanhedrin and capital punishment, I can't go through all the factors now. They're commanded to, it says, v'shaftu, they shall judge. They have to judge the murder. We're talking about capital cases. But built to, and they shall save. So there are many factors that are of mercy that are built in, because the judgment has to be tempered with compassion. And it's sort of tilted on the side of acquittal. It's more difficult to convict, because the objective is, if possible, to try and save a life. Now that's true in all cases except for one. The worst criminal in the system is called the Mesis. The Mesis is someone who seduces a fellow Jew into idolatry. Actually, any sin at all, but the punishment of death is when he seduces him into idolatry. Now, the Rambam then says that he is judged in a different fashion, not like other cases where people are being judged with the death penalty. In this case, he says, this is the only case where we're permitted to engage in entrapment. I can't go into explaining how we do it. That is, if he comes to one person, you need two witnesses. So normally we don't entrap a person into a crime. You have that in America today where they try and entrap people. They pose as people who want to buy drugs. Cops will do that, or even prostitution, prostitutes, in order to entrap. That's a controversial issue. In Judaism, it's not done except in one case, for the seducer. We entrap the person. And we tell them to come back later, and we have two witnesses hiding behind the curtain in order to, and we encourage him to say what he said before, we encourage him to commit the crime in order to trap him and to kill him. Nor does he require warning. In all other cases, you have to warn the person right before he does the act. And in all other cases, if he's acquitted, whenever a person is acquitted, he can't be subjected to double jeopardy. And then somebody else comes along and says that you made a mistake, he's really guilty, we can't retry him. And when if he's found guilty, if he's convicted and somebody protests you made a mistake and he can prove it, then we do retry him. So we're always on the side of mercy. Here it's just the opposite. If he's convicted, then he can't be brought back again to be acquitted. And if he's acquitted and somebody comes up with an argument for conviction, we do bring him back. So it's just the opposite. Nor do we, in general, the court has to try and find arguments to defend. If he can't think of arguments, he doesn't have any defense, so the court itself tries to find arguments in his favor. And also we don't allow certain types of people who are deemed judges, who would be judges, but they're deemed to be more harsh. Someone that doesn't have any children and so on. So people that we wouldn't consider to have enough sympathy, they don't sit in a case with where it's a matter of a capital case. Here we have them sit on such cases in order that they should, here's what the Rambam says. He says, in order that they should not have mercy on this person. So here's a situation where it is prohibited to have mercy. So you see that mercy per se is not a good. That mercy has to be considered from a broader perspective. What is the objective of that mercy? What will it bring about? And it's possible that mercy can bring about the greatest evil. That's why he says that cruelty to these people who cause the nation to err. Now what I'm saying over here would be applicable to something like Christianity, which is exactly the same thing. I'm not bringing it up for that reason, but I'm just, while I'm here, you can make that connection. I'm regarding that as the worst possible crime. Just like the Torah regards the Mesis as the worst possible criminal. He's a seducer. He's trying to seduce people from following the truth into a system of falsehood. That is considered to be the worst crime, and one is not permitted to have mercy on him. Now, I'm not saying this in a practical sense, that you shouldn't be nice to Christians. That's a separate idea. I don't want anybody to get the wrong impression. Well, I'm talking about Christianity. I'm not talking about people today who practice Christianity. I don't blame them for anything. What they have, they were brought up in this. They didn't create the system. They were brought up within the system. And by and large, because of the advent of democracy and being in America, they don't persecute anybody anymore, by and large. So my point is that we should respect people's rights to practice their religion. And I'm nice to all people. I'm nice to Christians and so forth. So I don't want anybody to get the wrong impression over here that I'm advocating that we should be hostile to Christians. That's not the case. Nor do I think it is false to say that if I disparage the religious beliefs, then it's automatic that I'm going to disparage them and to denigrate them and not treat them properly. That's absolutely false. A person has the ability to make this distinction. To say, I don't agree with your philosophy. I don't agree with your religious practices. To me, they're absurd. I wouldn't say that to the person. I'm saying there's no reason why you can't have such an idea. But yet, I respect you as a person with rights. You have rights. And I don't hate you because you didn't invent the system. To the contrary, I have compassion. And therefore, I can be friendly if you... I can help you in certain situations. If you ask me questions about the Judaism, I'll give you the truth, and so on and so forth. So I'm not saying anything here. The model for relations between Jews and Christians and Muslims in an open democratic society should be we respect each other's rights and we're good neighbors, but that's as far as it goes. The idea of trying to learn from them and be influenced by them is the most dangerous thing that could possibly happen for a Jew. Now the Rambam, getting back to the compassion issue, he says that cruelty towards these people who falsify, who try and deceive the nation after falsehood, rachamim hu ba'olam, it's merciful to the world. That's the mercy. So you can't just look at the immediate effect of your act. The immediate effect of your act can appear to be merciful, but in terms of the bigger picture, is cruelty. As he quotes the verse which justifies this treatment of the Mesis, the seducer, that the Torah says that we have to execute justice against these people in order that the anger of God shall be removed, and God will give you mercy. Now, this idea of compassion is a purely instinctual phenomenon, and it's taking the very act of compassion itself out of any context. Compassion per se is the good. That's not what the Torah says. And you ask a Christian, what would they do with an Arafat or even a Hitler? They'd be in a very, very tough situation, because compassion in that situation would be to let the person die. That would be the real compassion. Because you imagine you would nurse this person back to health, he goes back and he kills more innocent people. To the Christian, that would be... He may argue and say, well, we wouldn't let him back, and so on and so forth. That's just the avoiding the case. The point is, you are restoring this individual who is an evil person and giving him the opportunity to do more evil. That's why the Pope visited, he received Arafat, and he was very cordial to him. In my opinion, Christianity can never be a force for good in this world. Can never. Because, in my opinion, they don't even have a concept of the good. They can't have a concept of the good, because they maintain that there is no such thing as the good, since man is evil by nature. They'll never get over that problem. If man is evil by nature, and he's doomed to damnation, and the only way that he could be saved is if he believes in Jesus, so what difference is there between the worst sinner and the most righteous person? I know they try and work on that issue with all kinds of rationalizations. So, first of all, I'm saying that compassion by itself does not reflect the perfection of the soul, because it's rooted purely in the instinctual. It's an emotional phenomenon. It doesn't elevate the soul, because it's not motivated by any choice that the soul is making in terms of a recognition of the good, and in terms of a recognition of one's relationship with God. Bear in mind that they don't have a relationship with God, because they don't believe in God. So therefore, anything they're doing is brought about by an emotional reaction, and the philosophy is that the very act itself, unrelated to any objective, is inherently the good, when we see that the act itself can be an evil, where there are situations where you should let the person die. And by saving him, you're doing great harm. The next point I want to make is that you cannot judge. Let me ask you this question. What is the motivation? A, it could be either on the one hand, we're saying it's an emotional response, but it's more than that. It's part of a whole ideology. What motivates these people to go off and, like a Mother Teresa, give up every enjoyment in life? First of all, you have to analyze, is that correct? What about yourself and your own needs? And the way that God wants you to live. Is that the objective, that you should live a life of suffering and privation and not achieve the fulfillment of your own divine soul? But what motivates them to do it? Isn't it the ideology that they believe in? Aren't they doing it because they believe that whatever, for example, it's the same thing that motivates a Islamic terrorist to bomb an airplane. Now, I'm not saying it's that evil, obviously, because they're not really killing anybody. To the contrary, they're trying to save lives. But in terms of the motivation, they believe that as a result of doing this, they're going to have a paradise. They're going to be in paradise. So now let's say you convince somebody that there's a being out there, a being that doesn't exist. But let's say you convince them that there's a super person out there. Because you start doing this when the person is a child and young and can't question. And you indoctrinate this person with these beliefs of this super person out there that's looking over him and watching him throughout his whole life and is going to love him if he does certain things. Love. Everybody wants to be loved by super person. And then if he spends his entire life sacrificing himself and doing for others, the most gruesome tasks that nobody would want to do, he will have eternal bliss in paradise, in imaginary paradise. And the person grows up believing this. Of course, it's difficult to do it, but he overcomes all of the resistances. Now, is this really a virtuous act? Because these people will argue that you tell them, but you're giving up your whole life. They'll say to you, what I'm giving up is very meaningless. It's a short life. By any standards, it's over in no time. But I'm gaining eternity. Well, let's say that that's a very powerful argument. And most of the people that follow that religion do it for that reason. That's a factor, whether it's conscious or not. They're buying. It's like an insurance policy. So let's say the person, Mother Teresa, is she really that selfless? Assuming that to be selfless is a good thing. I don't see why that's a good thing. The Torah says you should choose the good. Or is she very selfish, extremely selfish? I say that all religious people are extremely selfish, but in a misguided way. Because everybody is selfless. There's no such thing as selfless. Nobody does anything except, there's no way. I maintain it's impossible not to be selfish. I maintain that what you see as the most selfless deed is selfish. A person commits suicide, a person gives up their life to save somebody else, that is selfish. Because the person did in their framework, whatever their framework was, that it was more important for them. That they should die and the other one should live. Or, put it a different way, it would be more painful for them if they allowed the other person to die and they would live. It would be too painful for them. Whatever choice you're making is because the way it appears to you, this is the better of the options. If a person commits suicide, for whatever reason, it's to escape something. So in his framework, he'd rather be dead than face the pain. But that's his framework. It's a selfish framework. There's no way you can change that. The only thing is, there's intelligent selfishness, and there's misguided selfishness. There's nothing but selfishness. People use the word selfless in a purely descriptive way. It means that they see their selfish interests being served by doing things that benefit other people. That's their selfishness. Now, someone like Mother Teresa, who sacrifices everything, I don't know why people think that so. Is she sacrificing everything? Does she believe at the end of the day she's going to have nothing and all the other people will have something? Or does she believe at the end of the day she's going to get that big hug from God or whatever it is she's waiting for? So that's why she did it. So what's compassionate about it? What makes that the good? It's a very selfish kind of a phenomenon. So what I'm saying is that you can't isolate the act of compassion from the context that's motivating it. And if a person were to see that starkly, it would be the same thing if somebody stops by, is on the way home, and there's somebody in danger and someone needs help. And you know, for whatever reason, let's say you know, someone told you, this wealthy guy, this billionaire. And you know for a fact that if anybody gets him out of that, he'll set you up for life. He'll give you $100 million, whatever it is. And then you jump into the fray and you do everything. Would you say that that's really compassion? The motivating factor. So what's different over here? But not only that, if you're doing it, whenever you're doing a deed, you're doing it in the name of Christianity, you're doing it in the name of Islam, how is that deed going to elevate you to a higher level? It's only going to make you more entrenched in something which is false. How does that perfect the soul? So we say that the value of compassion is if it elevates the soul, perfects the soul, and brings you closer to God because of your recognition of God and what the ultimate good is. So compassion has to be based upon the good. If you don't have a concept of the good, then you really can't do much compassion.
And you're going to be doing a lot of harm because it's going to be indiscriminating. It's not going to discriminate between a case where you should do compassion and a case where you shouldn't do compassion. And thus, the only truly compassionate individual is one who has true ideas as to the good. And one who does so, yeah, it's also selfish. What I'm saying, you'll ask, well, yeah, of course it's selfish, but this is the true self. There's a true selfishness. Everybody is selfish. Except there's a selfishness which is rooted in what is really the good and which elevates your soul and brings you closer to God because you're acting in a manner which is pleasing to God, so to speak, which is in line with the will of God. That is the ideal of compassion that we're talking about. Now, the other religions do not have that ideal. They're lacking that whole system, that whole knowledge. So therefore, what they're doing appears superficially to be what we would call compassion. But when you analyze it and you understand the structure, where it's coming from, what's motivating it, and what it's leading to, it is something which is leading to the glorification of a whole religion which is false. That's what I say. It's a completely different ideal. Now, I'm not going to disparage it because there are certain cases where it's useful, where it helps people, where it helps a good person. Obviously. I'm not saying it's of no use whatsoever. The fact that a false system may produce, I mean, they have hospitals, they may have doctors, they do research, they may discover cures. I mean, that's not the criteria. If they discover a cure for something, so fine, they discover a cure. Those things are byproducts, are accidents. They cannot be used in any way, shape, or form to validate the system if the system is founded on false foundations. So I'm not going to say that there, no good ever comes out of anything that they do. That's not the argument. They during the Holocaust, well, Christianity as a whole was a failure during the Holocaust, as a whole. It didn't come out and protest and take the stance that it ought to, neither did the church, neither did the Pope. But there were individuals who practiced compassion. I wanted to mention another point also. It's important to remember that aside from the two factors that I mentioned, there's another very powerful factor in Christian compassion. Because you could ask yourself the question of why. Why is that so important to them? Why is it so important for them to save somebody who's in physically in trouble? There's no question that, I don't have the statistics here, but a major factor is to missionize them. They're saving their souls for Jesus. So the whole thing is false. That's a major, when they set up these missions in Africa, and they build hospitals and they take care of really sick people and children, the real objective is to win their souls. So there too, you see, it's part of what they regard as being their ultimate purpose, which is falsehood. It's not the good. All of these factors cast doubt, so what kind of compassion is that? If I'm doing all kinds of good things to someone because I want to take advantage of you, because I want to seduce you, that's why I'm doing all these things. You don't know that, but I'm doing it just to seduce you. So of course you would you'd frown upon a person like that. A doctor that takes care of a patient, or they're clergymen or rabbis, whatever, that do all kinds of nice things for people, and then they try to seduce them using the influence that they've established. So you don't say in retrospect that they did good things. The whole thing is tainted because it was for an ulterior purpose, which is regarded as an evil. So that's their ulterior purpose, which is to win over there, to destroy their souls, basically. So I've shown you from every possible angle, we've broken down the practice of compassion. Purely without reference to their motives or anything, just the mere fact that it's rooted in the human instincts. It's an emotional reaction. In and of itself, it's not based upon any element of the Tzelem Elohim, of the divine element. It doesn't differentiate. It takes the physical act of helping someone in and of itself, unrelated to any context, and makes that into an end in itself. Which we've shown that can't be the case, because on that basis you could do a lot of evil. then I've shown that it's a purely selfish phenomenon because the person's only doing it because he has certain premises of how he's going to be rewarded for it, the structure of reward. So then it's a selfish thing. And if it's a selfish thing, then okay, selfishness is good provided it's based upon the correct selfishness. And then I've shown that the ultimate objective of all of their deeds is to destroy the person's soul by getting that person to believe in Jesus. So for these reasons I say that we cannot benefit at all from their practice of compassion because it's based upon false ideas. And everything that any religion does ultimately is going to go back to its basic premises. So if anyone is asking us to join together and to be inspired by the practices that they engage in, because superficially it may appear that they're doing something that we endorse, is absolutely false. There's no such thing. Every religion is based upon certain underlying premises, their belief system. And ultimately you're going to get back to that belief system, and that's definitely true of their practice of compassion. So the way that we elevate ourselves in compassion or in any other area is to go back to the Torah's idea of compassion. Compassion is a major component of the Torah. The Torah introduced that idea. All these ideas were introduced by the Torah, the idea that all people are created with the divine image, the Tzelem Elokim, the divine soul. And what the ultimate good for man is, and where does compassion fit in, and when is it compassion, and when it's not compassion, this is all part of Torah study, and only the Jews who have the Torah have these principles. I want to reiterate again that what my point about all the other compassions is that it is not the Torah's ideal of compassion. It's something which is completely different. And if a person wants to improve himself in accordance with Torah, he has to turn to the Torah sources, to study it, to practice it, and to perfect himself in line with the Torah concept of compassion. And if he gets involved in alien concepts of compassion, he's going to lose the Torah's ideal, and he's going to get caught up in a false ideal. So the other religions represent different and false ideals of the compassions and the various virtues in every area. You go through every area, you will see that. What they extol, for example, we'll come back to this theme later on if you remind me. We don't have too much time now. Things that they extol, for example, how their priests or whatever supposedly are celibate, or they give up a lot of pleasures and so on and so forth. When you look at that from the standpoint of Torah, that is an evil. That's not a good. Because if it's not in accordance with the way God wants you to live, so then why would we look up to that? And then you'll find that there are rabbis that will praise them. Look at how they sacrifice. Look how much they give up. Yeah, but that has to be analyzed. Does that represent an ideal, or is that just their own emotions in terms of what they're afflicting themselves, that they're taking affliction and making it into a good, which is really an evil because that's contrary to the will of God. Thus, you have to analyze every aspect of everything that they do, and you will see that it's false and falls far short of what the Torah's ideal is.